Okay, so I was asked to give some references, and so I put some on the board here. These first two are general texts of sort of general relativity, and they have discussions of the standard four-dimensional black holes that I described in my first lecture. Wald, well, mostly does Schwarzschild, but has all the Penrose diagrams and talks about the asymptotic conformal completion in great detail. D'Inverno does some Schwarzschild and also gives the discussion of the charged Reisner-Nordström metric that I mentioned with all the Penrose diagrams. So these are 4D black holes. These next two papers discuss the higher dimensional black P-brains. The first, by Duff Curry and Liu, is a long review article published in Physics Reports, which goes through all the metrics, discusses various properties, various dualities, connections between them in great detail. The second paper is much shorter, discusses many of the metrics we talked about, not all of them. This is the ones in which the dilaton was constant. Well, it has the 11-dimensional metrics and some of the 10-dimensional metrics I'm going to talk about today. But it discusses the sort of analytic continuations and the global structure of those metrics. Not quite in the coordinates that we used today, but close enough. So. Then here are some papers on positive energy theorems, which I'm going to be describing in today's lecture. So the original proofs due to Schoen and Yao and Witten were published in the articles here. And the new conjecture, which I'm going to mention at the end, is in a paper that appeared just a few months ago. This is in Physical Review. Okay. So at the end of last lecture, I was starting to talk about the 10-dimensional black P-brains. So the 10-dimensional n equals 2 supergravity, I said, has many fields, but we're going to focus on the metric, the scalar dilaton, and some forms of various rank. I'll write it as a P plus 2 forms. And the action, I said, is e to the minus 2 phi times the Einstein action, the scalar curvature, 4 times the gradient of phi squared minus the square of this P plus 2 form. Now, you might think it's going to be a lot harder to find extrema of this action, because the field equations will involve exponentials of the scalar, and it looks like it's going to be a lot more complicated. But in fact, you luck out. The equations, if you assume the same symmetry that we were assuming before, look for things translationally invariant along the brain and spherically symmetric around it. The equations, the ODEs you get, are just as easy to integrate as before. And in fact, the solutions take remarkably similar form. And in fact, for any p, so I'm going to be considering here a whole class of solutions where p goes from 0 up to 6. And all those solutions can be written down in a single, in a uniform way, which actually is very similar to the metrics we were looking at yesterday. So the manifold is just, again, the product of a sphere, S, sort of 8 minus P cross R, P plus 2. We're in 10 dimensions. And the metric is just some function of R to the minus 1 half now. And again, minus F of R dt squared plus some directions along the brain plus H to the plus a half times dr squared over this function of r r squared d omega. This is now an 8 minus p sphere. Where, as before, h is just 1 plus some constant over r to the right power, which in this case is 7 minus p. F is 1 minus a constant over r to the same power. The scalar dilaton, e to the minus 2 phi, is in fact given just in terms of this function h. It's h to the p minus 3 over 2. And the form is, again, f is equal to dA, where A is again given by, proportional to, 0, 1 to p component is proportional to 1 minus h inverse. So it's very, very similar to the metrics we were looking at yesterday. And as before, because of this structure of the metric, there's an event horizon. At r equal to r0, a singularity at r equal to 0. The two parameters, r0 and r1, are again related to the mass and the charge of this black p-brain. So these are 10-dimensional black p-brain. Where, of course, there's now I here goes from 1 to p. Oh, I should say there's one caveat here. This is true for p not equal to 3. For p equal to 3, the form is now a phi form, and it has to be self-dual. So there's an exception for p equal to 3. F5 is self-dual, so there's also more components to the F-field. Well, p equals 3 is special for another reason. You see that's when p is 3, the scalar dilaton actually becomes constant. And that is, makes this special case quite important. And one way to see how important that is to ask what happens in the extremal limit. So the extremal limit of these metrics, I haven't given you the formulas for the mass and the charge, but they're similar to what we had yesterday. And the extremal limit again corresponds to r0 going to 0. So the function f just becomes 1. All of the properties that we had seen, the special properties of the extremal limit, occur for all of this family of black p-brains. You again get the extra symmetry in this along the brain. You get the Boost symmetry, the full Poincaré invariance in the p plus 1 dimensions. You get a linear equation for h as your sole field equation, so you can superpose them. And most importantly, you find unbroken supersymmetry. So these are, these again have sort of 1/2 unbroken supersymmetry. It's not called a p plus 2 brain because you look at the number of spatial extended dimensions. And this solution has t extended spatial dimensions. It has the p plus 2 comes about because you have a time direction. So indeed, the world sheet of a p-brain is a p plus 1 dimensional object. So that's p plus 1 dimensions. But the extra dimension here is a radial direction transverse to the brain. moving away from the brain, you get another sort of radial direction. And then the other directions are the spheres, which sort of enclose everything. Okay, so these metrics have unbroken supersymmetry, and they are, in fact, the field produced by something called a D-brain. So Joe will talk more about D-brains. So these are the fields, the metric, this Ramon-Ramon T-form, P plus 2 form, F, and the dilaton are all, these are the fields sort of produced by something called the D-brain, which you will be hearing more about in the lectures next week. Now, if you look at the solution in this limit when R0 goes to 0, you find that they are, in general, still singular at the horizon. This is something which didn't happen before, but because we now have this scalar field phi, which is blowing up, it typically goes to either plus or minus infinity as R goes to 0. And this is telling us, well, you can sort of also see it by studying the metric, that the solutions, the metric itself, will still have a curvature singularity at R equal to 0 in this extremal limit. You will not get a smooth horizon, which we had in 11 dimensions without this the scalar field. So extremal metrics have singularities. R equal to 0. And this is true for all these P brains except P equals 3, which is the case when the dilaton is just constant.
Harry, which of these examples come from 11 dimensions reduced on S1?
Okay. The 11-dimensional theory reduced on S1 gives you the so-called 2A theory, and that includes these examples with P even. Okay, so this is sort of the dimensional reduction is from 11 dimensions. And the odd forms come in this other other theory.
Options that we are writing there is in the string frame.
Right.
So when you say the metric has singularity, do you mean in terms of the string frame or?
It actually is true in both frames. That's right. So I'm writing the metric here, which is the same metric which appears in that action. So this is the so-called string metric. You can, of course, do a conformal rescaling to get rid of that e to the minus 2 phi factor in front of the scalar curvature. And that's called the Einstein metric. And that would give you a metric which is this multiplied by some power of h, just multiplied by some power of the dilaton. But if I remember correctly, I'm going to describe the situation for the string metric, but I'm quite sure that you don't get out of this problem by rescaling to the Einstein metric in general. Yeah. Okay, so in terms of the other metric, so you get something which is a rescaled, well, this is now the scalar curvature of what I'll call the Einstein metric. Well, first of all, what is the relation? The Einstein metric, you can easily check, is just equal to e to the minus phi over 2 times the metric I had up there. And then in terms of the Einstein metric, you get this. It's minus 1/2 grad phi squared. And then you get various powers. You get e to the, well, alpha phi, where alpha is a constant which depends on p, times these f p plus 2 forms. So you pick up this coupling between the dilaton and these things, where it just depends on sort of how many inverse metrics you need to contract all the indices of your p form and stuff, p plus 2 form. Oh, no. No, no, no. No, you probably could get rid of the grad phi term completely if you sort of allowed yourself some more general rescaling and kept this sort of different power of phi here. So you can't get rid of the phi in front of the Einstein term and get rid of the kinetic term for phi. That's true. I mean, there is dynamics in phi, and you have to see it someplace. Okay, so this was a little bit of a digression. So I'm going to be working with this so-called string metric for the moment. But let me just show you what the geometry looks like if we go to the extreme limit. You can write down one of these Penrose diagrams again, and what you find, okay, so you find that for P, well, this R equals zero singularity is null. It's not surprising. You had a horizon there. Well, you're sort of bringing together this horizon, which used to be at R equal to R naught, and letting R naught come to zero, having it hit into the singularity at R equal to zero. And what you find is the Penrose diagram looks like this, with sort of a null singularity here. And this is still infinity, what I was calling sort of scribe plus and scribe minus on the first lecture. This is the sort of causal structure of these extremal black P brains when P is not equal to 3, because of course then it's non-singular, and when it's not equal to 6. The P equal to 6 case actually has a time-like singularity. So this is in fact an example of what I promised you in the first lecture a couple days ago, of a space-time with a time-like singularity looking just like the negative mass Schwarzschild solution, which we said was completely unphysical and had better not be allowed in string theory. And yet this metric, the P equals 6 extremal solution here, is supersymmetric. It had better be allowed in string theory because we know that these D6 brains, these six-dimensional D brains, are part of the theory. And yet in 10 dimensions, it looks just as bad as negative mass Schwarzschild. One way of seeing that this metric is really not so bad is to lift it up to 11 dimensions. So it's just pointed out that these solutions with P even actually can be obtained by dimensionally reducing an 11-dimensional metric. And if you lift this up to 11 dimensions, it actually becomes non-singular. So this is non-singular. In 11 dimensions, it becomes something called the Kaluza-Klein monopole cross R6, or the four-dimensional Euclidean Taub-Nut metric cross R7. Okay, it's just some smooth metric in 11 dimensions. Okay, but now let me come to the P equals 3 case, which is really the one which is non-singular. That, first of all, has a causal structure which looks like this 5 brain in 11 dimensions. It's completely non-singular. And it has one of these funny diagrams which just keeps going. So the surface R equals 0 now just becomes a regular horizon. You have one asymptotically flat region over here, another asymptotically flat region over here, which you can sort of think of as R going to minus infinity. All that stuff is not quite right, probably, in these coordinates. But it's a completely non-singular solution. We can now ask about the near horizon limit of this metric. And the near horizon limit is obtained as we did before by rescaling R so that we're looking just at the region near R equal to 0. So we let R equal to lambda times R tilde, T equal to T tilde over lambda, yi equal to yi tilde over lambda. And you see P equals 3 is particularly nice, because then all those powers which appear in H are it's like R to the 4th, or 1 over R to the 4th, and we have H to the 1 half appearing in the metric, so that just gives you R squared. And so the net result is that in the limit, lambda going to 0, this just reduces to R tilde squared over R1 squared minus D tilde squared plus yi squared. And we're in P equals 3, so this is now a 5-sphere. And what you see is that this is now just a product. This is an S5. And this metric, I is now going from 1 to 3 for P equals 3. And that's just the constant negatively curved metric in 5 dimensions, which is this what we call ADS5. So the near horizon geometry reduces to the simple metric product of a space of constant negative curvature, a space of constant positive curvature. And in this case, the radii are exactly the same. The radii is this parameter R1 in both cases. Now, you can do something a little bit more general than what I've been talking about so far in taking this near horizon limit. So far, I've taken the extremal limit first and then gone near the horizon. But you don't have to do that. You can actually keep R0 non-zero in the metric. Take a near horizon limit where you scale R0 to 0 at the same time as you're scaling R to 0. So more generally, sort of keep R0 not equal to 0, but rescale R0 equal to lambda times R0 tilde. And then you see that this factor F just doesn't change. It stays there in the metric as you approach this extremal limit. And so you end up with a metric. Now the limit lambda going to 0 is going to give us a metric which looks like this. First of all, it's still going to be a metric product, because nothing is going to change the fact that the spheres, the 5 spheres, will completely decouple. They didn't know about R0 in the first place. But what's going to change is that this 5-dimensional metric is now not going to be constant curvature. It's not going to be ADS5, but it's going to be modified by this function F. So, well, since I'm actually going to need this, let me rewrite it just one more time, because this is actually going to play a role in the positive energy theorem I'm coming to. So it's just the metric, the 5D metric, is this thing with the R0s in it. And it's now just, it's to the 4th power still. No, that's right. This is just reversed. And you have the same factor, R0 to the 4th over R to the 4th in the denominator there. Okay. So let me just keep this for the moment. What this describes is a black hole in 5-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. A space-time which asymptotically looks like a space of constant negative curvature, but as you move in, you now find that you have this structure of an event horizon and the singularity at r equal to 0. Okay. Are there any questions? Yeah.
Remind me what the Hamilton diagram was for p equals 7.
P equals 7. P bigger than 6 start becoming exceptional cases. And the reason is that if you're in 7 dimensions, then you have an 8-dimensional sort of world volume. You have only 2 transverse dimensions, so it's like being in a 2-dimensional world. The mass starts, any non-zero mass actually produces conical singularities and things like that. I don't remember offhand what happens in 7 dimensions or higher. Okay, any other questions?
Keep.
Okay, the D brain can be thought of as the source. So what I've been doing here is solving the supergravity equations, which just correspond to these fields. There's the metric, there's the dilaton and stuff. But I haven't put in anything which look like sort of point particles or point charges or anything which would sort of generate these fields. So we think of Schwarzschild, for example, which is a vacuum solution. It's Ricci flat, and there's no matter any place in there. But you have all this curvature, and you have all this gravitational field, and we think of it as the result of matter which has collapsed, right, is undergoing gravitational collapse, and is somehow sitting at the singularity, infinite density matter sitting at the singularity. So similarly with these black P brains, or charged, black P brains, you can think of them as the gravitational field produced by some source, which is in some sense already collapsed and is sort of sitting someplace at the singularity. So the D brains are the sources. So Joe will talk about the fact, at least, well, in weak coupling, you can describe these simply in flat space. And they are actually, well, they're the generalization of just point charges that you would add to your theory. And so supergravity doesn't have these as fundamental sources, but string theory does. And so string theory describes these as fundamental sources, and then what the supergravity gives you is, in some sense, the fields produced by these sources when you're sort of at some distance away from the source. Jenny? Right.
So is there any analogous understanding of collapsing in a finite size that can matter to form these sources so that we can really understand what kind of sources they are?
Collapsing finite size bits of matter to produce.
Finite size thing that produces this field of the endpoint collapse.
If you're not in the extremal limit, I think there's no problem, right? If you want to reproduce the fields of these general non-extreme P-brains, then I think, you just take a bunch of D-brains of the right dimension, you give them some kinetic energy, so they're all sort of collapsing together, you end up with something with more mass than charge, and you'll produce one of these non-extreme black P-brains. It's very hard to produce an extremal solution. Right, and so it's much harder to think of the extreme solutions as produced by some sort of collapse. But the non-extreme works just like Schwarzschild.
So in the example you gave yesterday for the rational solution for a membrane in different dimensions, in the extreme limit, you have time-like singularity and then you have horizon.
Right.
It looks like touching each other in the conformal diagram that it is actually not.
Right.
In that sense, if you are outside of the horizon, the Cauchy problem is well posed in some finite 3D.
If you stay outside the horizon,
and
that's
so
true.
As far as the curvature of the horizon is not large enough, then you can trust gravity approximation.
Absolutely.
What is the status of P brain when P is not 3 or 6, where you have light
singularity? Well, let's see. So there's two questions I guess you might ask. If you just ask about if you're not worried about corrections to the geometry, and you just say, okay, let me give you this geometry, can you evolve fields in this background? Then the answer is yes. In this background, this is what's called the Cauchy surface. And given initial data on this surface, you could uniquely evolve a hyperbolic equation every point inside the space-time. Well, the singularity at this point on the surface could only propagate and affect values of the field, which are really not part of your space-time. The field here is going to be a function only of the initial data inside its past light cone. And at any finite point in the space-time, that intersects the finite region of your surface, which is non-singular. So you indeed get unique evolution in this geometry, but not here. Right? The time-like singularity is very different, and you could have points up here which are clearly going to run into trouble. Okay, so you don't have unique evolution here, but you would have it here. Right. Well, it doesn't necessarily open up. You see, that depends on whether the dilaton is going to strong coupling or weak coupling.
Yeah, so for P less than 3.
Right, so for P less than 3, it depends on whether the power here is positive or negative. For P less than 3, the dilaton is going to strong coupling. It's going to plus infinity. That means that the 11th dimension is getting very big in terms of the reduction. And so you would be more inclined to view this as a dimensional reduction of an 11-dimensional solution. When p is bigger than 3, then the extra dimension is getting very small. And then, that's to decide if that's a useful thing to do. The causal lines do not... that's right. Certainly the light cones are unaffected by conformal rescalings. But you're rescaling by something, a conformal factor, which is becoming singular at r equal to 0. And so it might, in principle, change the nature of the singularity at r equal to 0. In response to another question, I think that the statement is the same in the Einstein metric, but I'm not 100% sure. I should check it. Well, I've given a few examples of these black P-brain solutions with lots of symmetry. People have, over the years, found many, many more examples of black P-brain solutions. You can, for example, add angular momentum, add rotation to these brains, and break some of the symmetry. You can consider solutions with more than one type of charge. I've always considered solutions where it's only had sort of one type of charge. But you could have several of these forms non-zero at the same time. And a lot of work has been done in constructing those solutions. You can even add sort of waves, some of these PP waves that Gary Gibbons was talking about. These plane waves can be added to some of these extreme black P-brains. And so there's a host of new or different geometries that one can construct along these lines. But in the last half hour or so, I thought I would talk about something different, which is not more examples of specific solutions, but general properties of solutions. What do we know about sort of solutions as a whole? And this is, particular in connection with positive energy. So let me... So let me start with a very brief history. So from about 1960 to 1980, for about 20 years, people worried about the following question. If you take matter, ordinary matter, with positive local mass density, and put it together in general relativity, given matter with sort of density, which is just positive, is the total energy that you see at infinity always positive? Now, Now that might seem obvious until you realize that the total energy that's measured at infinity includes gravitational potential energy. And in Newtonian theory, the gravitational potential energy is negative and is in fact unbounded from below for sources which are, you know, arbitrarily compact. So in Newtonian theory, we know that the potential energy phi, you know, goes like minus m over r. And so if you take two very compact objects and bring them very close together, you could take advantage of this and get arbitrarily large amounts of negative potential energy and easily construct situations where the total energy is negative. So the answer to this question is simply no in Newtonian theory. Well, if the same thing was true in general relativity, it would be a disaster, because you would then have sort of no stability for Minkowski space. You could bring these objects with negative total energy in contact with things with positive total energy, and they would sort of go off accelerating through the universe. It would be a real problem in Einstein's theory. However, there is a sort of plausible way of avoiding this in general relativity. If you try to take these compact objects and bring them close together, relativity predicts that you form black holes. And black holes, we expect, will have positive mass. And so the hope is that these black holes will somehow protect us and not allow us to construct any configuration with negative total mass. So the hope is that you form black holes and the energy stays positive. Well, as I said, this was something that people struggled with and tried to prove for over 20 years. It's easy to see why it was a hard problem. First of all, this is all something you can discuss in the context of an initial value formulation. So you're really talking about just one moment of time. You consider initial data. So this is describing by some three metric, Gij, and some extrinsic curvature, say Kij. You have some statement that the mass inside is positive. Locally, the matter density is positive. But the total mass, the total energy of the solution, is something which is determined and read off from the asymptotic behavior of the metric. I'll give you a precise definition in a minute. But the total energy really comes from the sort of leading order deviations from flatness. It's from the asymptotic. Depends only on the three metric, asymptotically. And so you want to deduce something about how the metric behaves asymptotically from some condition about what's happening in the interior. And these are related through the Einstein constraint equations, which are a rather complicated set of nonlinear elliptic equations. Well, Schoen and Yao first proved that in the first set of references I gave you in 1979 by cleverly using minimal surfaces. They argued that if the total mass was negative, they could construct some sort of complete minimal two-surface in here, but then by looking at its variation, they got a contradiction. Witten, a few years later, came up with another proof of why the mass couldn't be negative, which involved just a simple linear equation on a spinner. And that Witten's proof was motivated by supersymmetry, because there's a formal argument that formally in a supergravity theory or any supersymmetric theory, the Hamiltonian is the square of some Hermitian operator. And so if you buy the whole structure of quantum supergravity, the energy of any state would have to be the square of something which would have to be positive. Of course, people in classical relativity, I mean, this argument was noticed earlier. This was actually first proposed around 77, I think. And people in supergravity were really happy because they proved something about classical relativity. But nobody in classical relativity believed this, because you had to assume all of the structure of quantum theory in order to get a result which was purely classical. Well, and in a sense, what Witten did was to sort of extract from this sort of supergravity argument what was sort of the essential ingredient and rewrite it in a purely classical way involving an ordinary commuting spinner, solving some ordinary elliptic equation, linear equation, which magically combined just the right information you needed to sort of relate the interior structure to the total mass. Yeah. You don't have to assume that explicitly. You actually prove that. So the first proofs never even mentioned black holes. They just assumed you had some complete Riemannian free manifold with arbitrary topology, and they assumed that the the matter was locally positive in here, and they proved the energy. So they never even talked about black holes. Later on, a few years later, people generalized the argument so that you could put in boundary conditions at a horizon. So then they said, okay, it doesn't matter what happens inside an event horizon. If you have an event horizon and you have positive energy outside, then you prove that the mass is positive. So you don't have to assume black holes have positive mass. This gives it to you. Correct. Not only that, there's actually a much stronger statement, which was not proven. It was conjectured in the late 60s, well, early 70s, I guess, but not proven until just this year, or last year, which is that for black holes, you actually have a much stronger result, that the mass, well, I guess I should be consistent here. What am I? I'm calling it the energy. The total energy is actually bigger than something which is related to the square root of the area of the horizon. It's area over 16 pi, maybe, to the 1/2. For Schwarzschild, you get equality here. And the statement is that for any black hole, the energy has to be bigger than some bound given by the area. So you learn more than positivity. You get a lower bound based on the area. But this is very recent. Huiskin and Ilmedin proved it, I think, a year and a half ago. And Hugh Bray just had a new proof of this a couple months ago. So this is very recent. Absolutely. All of these metrics assume that you start with some initial surface which is completely non-singular. Because you have to rule out the negative mass Schwarzschild and things like that. Yeah, so they all assume that. Okay, let me, I want to give you a precise statement of what was proven here. So let me first give you a definition of what this total energy is. And I'm going to, there's many, many ways of giving, of defining this energy. This is sort of called the ADM energy, if you want, or ADM mass in general relativity. And they're all just different ways of extracting sort of the leading order deviation of the metric from some sort of canonical metric at infinity. I want to give a definition which is general enough to work not only in the asymptotically flat context, but in the asymptotically ADS context that I want to use in a minute. And it's also general enough that it works in all dimensions. Okay. The bad news is that it doesn't work for every space-time because, well, in some sense, it works best for space-times which have some symmetries, and you'll see in a minute. So let's consider... okay, so let's consider one of these sort of Riemannian surfaces. So the Riemannian manifold. So we'll have some metric Gij on it. It could be in any dimension. But it has to asymptotically approach some canonical metric, which means that we're picking out some sort of reference background. And what we have to pick out is sort of the metric that this is going to approach at infinity. The reference background sort of must be a static solution to the field equations. So the reference, okay, and so the... because it's static, we can define a quantity which is the norm of the time-like Killing field. So d by dt squared is going to be something I'll call minus n squared. And the metric on a static slice is g0j. Okay, so this is just some background structure that you need to sort of define the mass. For asymptotically flat metrics, the natural background is just Minkowski space. Then this norm is just 1, so we don't have to worry about it, and this is just the flat Euclidean metric on the plane. But for ADS, things are a little more complicated. So then the formula, so then what you want to do is you want to consider a large surface, a large sphere, in this, in your Riemannian manifold. Oh, and we're going to require that G, the boundary condition, is that your original metric, of course, goes to Gij naught, the metric of your static or your sort of reference background, plus correction terms, which depend on the dimension. So terms of order, what is it, r to the minus d minus 3, I guess. Well, this is a space-time dimension, so the d minus, well, okay. D minus 3 if d is a space-time dimension. The space-like surface is one lower dimensional. Okay, so then the formula is that this total energy is equal to minus 1 over 8 pi times the integral over this surface at a large distance times this function n, sometimes called the Laplace function, times k minus k naught, where k is the mean curvature of your surface S in the original manifold, and K naught is the mean curvature of a surface which is isometric to your original surface. So you want to embed it isometrically in this reference background. Reference, well, in G naught, I guess. G naught ij. So this is the original manifold with metric Gij. And so this, if I didn't subtract off something, this would just diverge because this mean curvature doesn't fall off fast enough in asymptotically flat spaces for this integral to be finite. But if I subtract off its value in the reference background, which is its flat space value, it sort of picks out the leading order correction to the metric and defines the total mass. Yeah?
Is it correct that you only use the reference background at infinity?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you don't really need it everywhere?
No, you don't need it everywhere, but it's going to be some simple solution. I will extend it in. Right. It's an induced metric on S in Gij. Think of it as a sort of manifold of metric on its own right, and you just want to embed that isometrically in the background. Well, okay. No, you cannot always do that in a space of just one higher dimension, unless somebody can correct me and tell me that I can. That is the main restriction of this definition, which is that in most of these examples, you have a high degree of symmetry.
And why can you use the original ADM definition in terms of
the original ADM definition involved sort of ordinary derivatives of the metric in some asymptotically flat thing. That is okay in asymptotically flat spacetimes, but has to be modified if your spacetime is not asymptotically flat. Okay, and there are ways of doing that. I mean, so this is not unique in the only way of defining the energy, but I'm just saying that this is one way of defining it, which I know works in all dimension. So this is in any dimension, and basically for ADS, you know, as well as asymptotically flat. Asymptotically ADS and asymptotically flat. So it's general in that sense, yeah.
I'm sorry, I lost the thread of the logic of your answer.
Yeah.
You said you cannot asymmetrically add one gas without the two.
Right. Right. In general, you can't. Right. What's the catch? Okay, so the answer is that the definition can only be applied in those cases where you can, which restricts you to very special symmetric spaces. Okay. So that's probably, oh, I see. That's not going to be good enough, I guess, for proving a more general theorem.
So maybe you can work out through this definition what about some local formula.
Okay, so this was good enough for sort of computing the energy in various examples, but you're right. For a general proof, you want a more general definition. And there is a more general definition for each case, but it has to be modified a little bit. No, it actually, this term certainly contributes.
It's not the whole term, but small perturbation away from that term.
Right. That's certainly enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. So one could probably sort of modify this a little bit. You only need to how it behaves asymptotically. And asymptotically, you know that, you know, your metric is basically approaching this sort of standard simple metric, and your surface is approaching something which should be, you know, pretty close to a sphere or something in your nice reference background, and you want to just pick out the deviation. So, maybe this was not the best definition I could have given. There is a definition of mass in asymptotically ADS spacetimes, which doesn't require that you isometrically embed your surface in it, but. I hope the idea is clear, that you want to just be able to embed it sort of close enough to sort of subtract the leading order derivatives.
Just to make my question more precise, could you have done something like, say, suppose the surface is essentially a hypersphere, and do something like compute what K0 would be if it were totally round and no empty Euclidean space, and put that in the place of K0? Would that be close enough to the
I think yes. I think that's all you need.
I can see how you can do that.
Yeah.
the other guy, even the surface is computing K0. The best I know is, you know, the wild estimate is bound K0.
Uh-huh. Well, you only need it sort of asymptotically, right, for
a
large thing.
I mean, that's, but while it's getting closer.
Right.
Sure.
Okay, that sounds like it might be good enough. Okay, I think I should, I don't know if that's good enough. I mean, I think that you basically, in practice, you want to subtract just the result of sort of the round sphere in your, say, hyperbolic space, and that's sort of a simple computation, and that should take off the leading divergence, and I think everything else will be fine. So let me move on, or else I'm not going to get to the sort of new conjecture. But if people are interested, I can certainly talk to you afterwards and maybe provide a definition which is more, is precise and works in more general cases.
What is N?
What is what?
N.
N was defined to be this norm of the static Killing field in this reference background metric. So in flat space, it's just 1. In this asymptotically ADS case, N is going to be growing with R in the sort of area coordinate I was using. Okay, well, first of all, what's the sort of result that was proven before? The result that was proven before is that, and let me, again, sort of just to save time, not state it in complete generality, but let me suppose that the extrinsic curvature is 0. So just take this sort of so-called time symmetric case. I'm using too many things. Suppose the initial data has only the metric, this say 3 metric GIJ, and the momentum conjugate to it is 0. Then this relation between the mass density and the curvature is very simple. It's just saying that the scalar curvature of this metric has to be positive. And so the form of the positive energy theorem in this case is, say, given a complete Riemannian, say, 3 manifold with positive scalar curvature or non-negative scalar curvature, then this total energy is greater than or equal to 0, and it equals 0 if and only if the metric is flat. Okay, so that's the statement of the positive energy theorem in the case when we don't have to worry about this momentum conjugate to the metric. And this theorem was extended. It was first shown in 3 dimensions, but it was also shown to hold in higher dimension. For manifolds which are either asymptotically flat or are, say, sometimes you're interested in these products, higher dimensions, for asymptotically flat in the full higher dimensions, or manifolds which are globally a product, or M equals, say, a product of K and some other space, and asymptotically flat, so say with K compact and and M tilde asymptotically flat. It does not hold for manifolds which asymptotically go to, say, something cross a compact space, but when the total space is not globally a product. So this does not hold for for manifolds which are, say, so for M going to, say, just, let's take the simplest case, S1 cross R4, this is just an example, asymptotically, sort of near infinity, but not globally a product. And The simplest way to see this, I don't want to erase this because I'm going to still use it in a second. Actually, let me not give the example because I'm going to run out of time. But I can give you their explicit examples of initial data, even in this time-symmetric context where you only have to worry about the three-manifold, which actually have zero scalar curvature and have arbitrarily negative energy, which are completely non-singular. Well, if I have time, or if you ask a question, I'll write it down for you. It's very easy to construct. But, okay, so that's the statement for spacetimes that are asymptotically flat. Now the question is, what happens if it's asymptotically anti-de Sitter? Well, the basic theorem was proven. So for spacetimes which asymptotically approach an anti-de Sitter metric in all directions, sort of globally approach asymptotic ADS, the theorem is still true, in the sense that the energy, of course, you're sort of subtracting off the sort of pure ADS result. So this, by definition, gives zero energy for ADS, and you're looking at sort of deviations from ADS. So this theorem is true. Well, I guess I should write down something about, there is, of course, one key difference. We're not talking about scalar curvature, which is positive anymore. We have to put in the negative curvature. And so we need so let's see. So the actual theorem, which is proven in the ADS case, asymptotically ADS. Well, I keep saying ADS, but of course I'm always looking at a space-like surface, and so these are just metrics that are asymptotically hyperbolic. So these are asymptotically hyperbolic metrics. So G naught IJ is now just the standard. It's a hyperbolic metric. So then the statement is that if the so there's a theorem which says that, again, non-singular Riemannian manifold now with scalar curvature greater than or equal to some negative number, which is sort of this radius of curvature of ADS, so well, minus, well, this depends on the dimension. Well, let me just call it a constant, which is the which is just the result for this hyperbolic metric you're approaching. Non-singular Riemannian manifold with this property has the same conclusion, that the has the energy relative to this hyperbolic metric bigger than or equal to zero. I think it's even, I think it's even true that equality, if and only if it's hyperbolic. Okay, so now we come to the question. And the question is, what if you don't require that it sort of go to ADS, look hyperbolic at infinity, but allow it to be periodically identified? So it's locally hyperbolic, but you add some identifications. And there's actually two separate questions that you could ask. One comes by just taking, so this metric here. This is the ADS-5 case. If I analytically continue T, so I put a plus sign here. I'm going to analytically continue so T goes to I tau, and also say analytically continue one of these other directions to produce a new time-like direction, say Y1 comes to IT. Then I just get a plus sign here, and this becomes some, you know, minus new time plus some y squares. And remember I said when you analytically continue a black hole metric, you have to periodically identify tau so that it's smooth. So now we have a metric which at large distance, this term is negligible, looks, still has locally constant curvature, but one of these space-like directions is periodically identified. So if you write the hyperbolic metric in terms of the metric on the upper half plane and you have translational symmetries, you just make one of them compact. And the period here is related to this parameter R0. Well, the first thing to note is that if you simply take this metric that I've gotten by double analytically continuing the black hole metric and compute its mass using our standard formula, you find that it's negative. So this guy has less mass, less energy than the pure ADS. It is of the type of results that we talked about in the asymptotically flat case, where asymptotically it looks like it has, you know, one circle. A circle direction across R4, but the circle pinches off inside, so it's not globally a product. If this result, which was true in asymptotically flat space, that the energy can be arbitrarily negative, holds also in the asymptotically ADS case, it would, I think, essentially kill the ADS-CFT conjecture. The spaces that we've been talking about here, these metrics which are asymptotically ADS, correspond, are supposed to be described by ordinary field theory, ordinary Yang-Mills theory on a sort of Rn or a circle across Rn. The fact that this metric alone has negative energy is actually not a problem, because this can be understood in terms of the ordinary Casimir effect in quantum field theory, that if you compactify a direction, you can in fact lower the ground state energy. And we understand that. In fact, numerically things work quite well in relating the mass of this metric to the mass of the field theory in that it's supposed to describe. But if the energy could be made even more negative and is unbounded from below, we would have to conclude that the sort of field theory didn't have a ground state or was unstable. And that would be a big problem. So, from what I understand, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert, but from what I understand, mathematicians typically think that hyperbolic geometries are less constrained than asymptotically flat geometries. And things which are true in the sort of flat context should be true in the hyperbolic context, because you sort of have more freedom. But here's a case where we certainly don't want it to be true. And, well, so this is described in this last reference I gave, a paper I wrote last year with Rob Myers. And all we were able to do was to sort of check quadratic fluctuations about this and show that this was stable to small fluctuations. So locally, this is a minimum of the energy functional. But we certainly weren't able to say anything globally. So to sort of make this in the form of a conjecture, so what I want to do is I want to consider, say, just the t equals constant surface of this. Let me now take my reference background. So let G naught be the t equals constant, sort of the metric on the t equals constant surface. Of this sort of doubly analytically continued metric sort of star. And now I want metrics which just approach this asymptotically and ask if they always have bigger energy than this one. So the claim would be, given any sort of non-singular Riemannian manifolds with with the scalar curvature bigger than or equal to, for that particular metric, the constant is It can be written out as minus 12 over this R1 tilde squared. That's the sort of scale of the curvature. I didn't spell out what the boundary conditions are exactly. I don't know what they should be sort of precise enough for a mathematician, but roughly speaking, you want the metric to approach this metric asymptotically, you know, up to corrections, which are sort of the order where the R0s appear in that metric. Any non singular Riemann manifold with this figure, and Gij sort of going to G0 Ij appropriately, which I guess will have to be worked out once we see how to prove this, then the energy had better be positive relative to this metric. And possibly one could hope to show that it's zero only for this metric so that it's actually unique. This is really very strange because, unlike previous examples of the positive energy theorem, we're claiming that the minimum energy is not some nice symmetric space. It's not flat space, and it's not this hyperbolic space, which it was in the original generalization to ADS. It's this metric, which doesn't have any sort of redeeming features. It has a bunch of symmetries, but it's not constant curvature. It's not nice in any real sense. So anyway, so this is what sort of physics seems to require, and it's a pure math question, which I hope people can help answer. Thank you. Yeah. Well, it's not putting it at finite temperature, because when I have done the analytic continuation, what I'm describing is simply the solution on a circle across, say, R3 in this case. But it's really the ground state. It's at zero temperature. See, it's just the metric here in space-time is just minus dt squared plus dy squared. It's globally static. What's that? It would correspond to the gauge theory on S1 cross R3 at zero temperature with supersymmetry broken. Okay, I didn't go into this, but the spinners around this circle have to be antiperiodic just because of the way that this circle is actually the boundary of the disk in space-time. So you necessarily break supersymmetry, and so you have to, so you're looking at the sort of non-zero Casimir energy that you get for this broken phase.
The
Post-Boundary
Theorem proof. Have you used this energy definition in the string
frame
or in Einstein frame?
Oh, the dilaton is constant.
Sorry?
The dilaton is constant.
Are you sure this is the
case? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. See, I didn't, I guess, maybe emphasize that enough. This was the P equals 3 case in which the dilaton is constant. So that just drops out. And in fact, you can reduce this to just a statement about solutions of Einstein's equation with negative cosmological constant, or indeed, as I've done here, just a statement about Riemannian manifolds with some inequality on the scale of curvature. So the dilaton is gone, and in fact, the other fields are really out of the question. This is just a statement about geometry now. And for this case of the ADS5 or ADS4, there's the dilaton is constant, so it's not. There's no difference between the two metrics.
Is there a Bondi mass in this context?
A Bondi mass? Not really. Well, in some sense, the Bondi mass is the same. See, usually, in asymptotically flat space times, there's two different ways of going out to infinity. And if you go out in spatial directions, you get to this point at spatial infinity, and the mass I was talking about was sort of the ADM mass at spatial infinity. You could go out in null directions and define a total mass, which is the Bondi mass. In anti-de Sitter space, the sort of corresponding conformally completed space-time is just this cylinder, right? It's the inside of a cylinder. Infinity now becomes the time-like surface, And so there's no real difference whether you go out to this boundary in space-like or null directions. You just have a definition of mass which is defined over surfaces at infinity. Yeah? Ah, that's actually something I'm a bit worried about. There's a question there, which I don't know the answer to. The question is, what happens when you compactify more than one circle? In the field theory, we can compute how the ground state Casimir energy changes, and it decreases. Okay, if you compactify more than one circle, you lower the Casimir energy. In the geometry, you can trivially compactify these other directions if you want, but you're not changing the energy. You're not changing the energy density, which is really what we're talking about here. And so you don't see this extra decrease in the energy if you compactify more than one.
Does the extra circle you are compactified, does that also force the fermions to be antiperiodic?
No, you have a choice on those circles, whether they're periodic or antiperiodic. But in fact, the energy decreases even if they're periodic, if you compactify another circle. So there's another question here, which is, if you consider metrics which asymptotically approach this with some more directions compactified, is this the only, or is this the lowest energy state, or is there another solution, which we just haven't found yet, which has those boundary conditions, which is even more, which has lower energy? Hopefully there is one, but not sort of a whole unbounded sea of them. Maybe I. Thank you.